Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about IBM's open banking initiative, Tron tries to take on Ethereum and the world, and Umpqua sells its digital banking unit to a fintech. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. So he's the new Eisenhower, the data industrial complex.
It's a good line.
You know, it didn't work, though. It didn't really stop.
Yeah, Cassandra's...
Did the tide of history just
Cassandra's never win.
Yeah.
It's also a bit self-serving, right?
Yeah.
A lot self-serving.
And right.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's get started. With me this week, back from her sojourn around the world, is Monica.
Hey, John. It's good to be back.
Glad for you to be back.
Same.
And Steve.
Also glad to have you.
Who's
back.
Always here every week.
Never leave.
All right. Well, let's get started with the big guns. IBM is doing something with open banking?
That is right. So IBM recently announced that they're launching an open banking platform. I think this is a fairly clear response to GDPR and PSD2 in the UK and Europe.
But did they say that explicitly?
Nice, like, use of initials.
Thank you. I know all the acronyms, all the letters. I'm a master of letters. They didn't say it explicitly, but I think they're reading the tea leaves and seeing how there's now a data privacy law in California. There's something that may be going through Congress.
So IBM is trying to be like the neutral mediator in between banking information for different competitors?
Yeah, they're basically trying to host a number of APIs and ways in which banks can surface account information to their customers and sort of be that, again, that platform through which they can sort of embrace the open banking paradigm, if you will.
So they missed out on being the PC platform, and they're going to try it now with open banking.
That's their hope, yeah.
Well, hopefully Bill Gates doesn't jump into this market.
I think it's a bit late for Bill Gates.
He's got malaria to eradicate.
Yeah.
Steve, can you tell us what PSD2 even is?
PSD2 is the Payment Services Directive 2, the sequel. And it's a UK law that allows for the sharing of customer data more easily so that you can easily switch banks, you can easily see information from one bank in the different platforms, UX, if you will. And it's the thing that's enabled.
Steve,
a lot of
what is UX?
and was PSD2 better than the original?
I have no idea about PSD1, the original. No,
yeah, I think that was just a test they did at the beginning.
Yeah, I only know the sequel, not the original, but I'm assuming that 2 is better, right? 2 is better than 1. Sequels always rule.
So IBM wants to make it so JP Morgan is on their platform, then a smaller company can offer their services to those same customers. Why would JP Morgan want to do that?
Because by joining the IBM platform, they're able to offer some of their services and some of their functionalities across different platforms that are not JP Morgan owned. So that you can say, do bill pay with JP Morgan via a different bank's app or something.
Oh, and they might be confident that they can do it better.
Right.
Well, good luck to IBM. We certainly want to see that kind of transparency and competitive kind of platform that this kind of thing would imply. It sounds like there's a few steps away from bringing this to reality, just like in the UK. It's just starting out over there, too. Even though it's a law, it takes a lot to build up to this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep, agreed.
Well, our next article is on Tron. Yes. The 1982 movie that foretold everything in the future perfectly.
Again, with the sequel, I like the sequel, actually. And I also like the Daft Punk soundtrack.
Oh, was that the
You're
Olivia Wilde?
You're such a cool kid,
yeah.
Steve.
No, I don't know if it's a cool kid thing. It's the one with, the new Disney
It's the
one.
Son of...
The Son of Tron or whatever. The,
yeah,
the
yeah, Son of Tron.
Son of Tron, yeah.
Maybe we'll see a cryptocurrency named Son of
sure.
Tron
yeah,
someday.
That's the next step.
Daughter of Tron. Come
oh.
on, it's time.
Oh, yeah.
Well, actually, I'm talking about Tron, the cryptocurrency blockchain company trying to take over the world. And it is a company as well, started by Justin Sun, who says that his Tron platform is not 100, not 150, but 200 times faster in terms of transaction speed than Ethereum, which is kind of low bar because I think Ethereum is only like around 25 transactions per second.
Mm-hmm.
So,
so none of that is up to like what any good-sized bank is ushering through.
Right, right. Visa is like, I think, 30,000 per second or something like that. But still, something more usable. But that's not the whole story. So we're actually talking about Tron, the cryptocurrency, which is kind of taking the same stance as Ethereum, trying to be like a world computer, take over the internet on a blockchain. And just this week, Justin Sun had a little bit of a Twitter war. He's trying to start. He's been having this kind of trying to compare themselves to Ethereum.
And he wants attention, and it's working.
Yeah, we're talking about it.
Exactly.
Sorry, who is Justin Sun?
Justin Sun is the founder of Tron,
mm-hmm.
and the cryptocurrency pronounced TronX. TRX.
That just rolls off the tongue. Right
it just
there.
Rolls off. Tron. Yes. So Tron has a market cap of about $1.5 billion, and the number 11th largest market cap for a cryptocurrency, according to CoinMarketCap.com. So this company, there's a lot going on with this, and I wanted to talk about some of the other cryptocurrencies. Well, you know, I always mention Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Ripple as the large platforms where a lot of things will get built on. But some of these smaller ones do have a lot of resources. They're building up, and they could provide services in one part of the market. It might not be just one cryptocurrency or blockchain. And we've seen that on the enterprise side. But that's also true with these public permissioned type of blockchains as well. Now, Tron is focused on being a decentralized entertainment network. And what this means is they're trying to go into movies and TV shows and have this...
In what way go into movies?
Yeah, well, they...
To be used as the currency to fund them?
Yeah, I think that's one of the targets. They actually just purchased BitTorrent. So they have a project called Project Atlas.
Who knew
Atlas.
They were for sale?
Who knew that you could buy... I thought it was a protocol, not an actual company. But I guess
yeah,
they do
BitTorrent
make
that is... was just purchased. They're a majority shareholder. Some of the existing owners kept about 30% of the ownership. And what they're thinking of doing, it's called Project Atlas, is paying people in Tronix coins, TRX tokens, in order to encourage people to share more on BitTorrent. So kind of merging their cryptocurrency with BitTorrent.
Oh, so to actually pay people to exchange stolen copyrighted material?
Exactly, that's right.
Sounds like a beautiful incitement to fraud case coming Tronix's way.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, BitTorrent has some issues to work through, obviously. They exchange a lot of copyrighted material.
Is it used for anything else?
It's supposed to be used, to share like large files among scientists
sure.
or something.
But is it used for anything else?
No, I use it to get like Russian dub movies, for sure. Yes.
Steve has a lot of strange interests.
I do, yeah.
So Tron is trying to, I guess, legitimize Bitcoin, BitTorrent then. By using their coin and then having it be a real service. How they can verify what's copyright protected or not when there's millions and millions of users and I guess just as many files or more, they don't really get into. I try to find a research into that a little bit.
That's actually not a super difficult technical thing to tackle because I know that on YouTube, they do a really good job of actually blocking anything that's copyrighted.
But somebody has to complain. Audio. So you'll get a notice.
No, I think it's automated now so that when you upload it, it goes kind of a quick review process before it actually gets published.
How does it recognize every possible copyrighted item? I actually had to remove somebody that copied my videos and content. I complained to YouTube, and they sent them a notice. And...
I think the stature of the complainer has a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
So if you are like a Warner Brothers... and you've got this huge, very well-known bank of intellectual property you can probably do something behind the scenes with YouTube to have that screened. Whereas intellectual property that's been created on a much smaller scale, that's not necessarily going to be pre-identified by YouTube or by Google, is probably something that would require you to flag.
Yeah, it's definitely a big challenge. So I don't know how they're going to get around that. Maybe some kind of blockchain DRM.
Maybe they won't try.
Maybe they won't. So they don't mention specifically, but that's their goal as trying to be this entertainment network. Now they're getting away from that kind of focus, and they really want to be a platform. There's a lot going on with Tron. They have a lot of balls up in the air. So
they have a lot of balls.
They're trying to take on everybody. So another reason they were in the news recently is that they just were able to pass Ethereum's transaction volume this week also. So what kind of app do you think that they put out there on that works on their network that that managed to get enough transactions to pass someone much, much larger than them?
Not P2P.
Not P2P.
Not illegal downloads.
So it's like a software program.
LimeWire? Kazaa?
Oh, you're revealing your age more.
I don't LimeWire. Even have a guess.
I remember that. So they have a DApp, distributed application called TronBet, where you can gamble
using this app. Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I was going to guess porn.
That was probably a better guess. Yeah. Right. Isn't gambling on porn.
Off topic, but isn't gambling now legal in the MLB? Like, can you now bet on like baseball games nowadays?
I don't know. That's the least interesting sport ever, so I don't follow
it. I love baseball.
The Dodgers are going to take
it. You have a lot of strange interests. I think we've demonstrated that very well this episode.
Baseball's not strange. America's pastime.
Right. Yeah, it's baseball.
You're showing your age again,
yeah.
Steve.
Yeah. I remember when the Dodgers played the Red Sox the first time. So they were able to clock over 500,000 transactions, passing Ethereum, just briefly at least, with TronBet.
So people are making different kinds of bets using Tron X coins on TronBet.
The secured Tron X of blockchain, yeah. So they're working on other apps. This is one of the first major ones that's come out already. So they're, like I said, they're trying to decentralize the web, is how they put it. So yeah, always comparing themselves to the Ethereum, which has a similar goal.
But they do have a lot going on.
They do. They want to be the entertainment. They're working with BitTorrent. I always want to say Bitcoin. And developing their platform. So they have been getting some attention from Ethereum developers. They had some migration from Ethereum on an app called BitGuild. There's one called there's a game called Magic Academy that they've been able to develop on the Tron mainnet, which is their platform. So a lot of different things going on, and the BitTorrent play as well. So this is all getting worked on right now.
One of the things that I would be really interested to learn from developers in the crypto world is kind of what are your criteria for deciding, you know, where you want to be and on what currencies? You know, what are the things that you look for? So for Tron, I really don't want to put the X on it.
Tronix.
But for Tronix.
Tronix.
You know, the fact that it has a faster throughput on transactions than Ethereum, that seems to me to be a really nice thing. Even if it's not that fast compared to some of the more well-established players in the
Visa.
Traditional financial world.
Sure.
But that would be interesting. If any of our listeners want to let us know what you choose when you develop.
Yeah. And it's, you know, there's so many of these crypto assets that each have a different focus. You know, I want to get into some of the other ones in future weeks as well. Like I said, this is the 11th largest one, and there's a lot of interesting work going on. I mean, Ethereum is its own kind of platform and world, and has thousands of different applications being developed for it. So, yeah, let's see what happens. Let's see which falls out. Now, we know from other kind of tech booms that, you know, the technology might win, but the individual players don't, you know, it's always hard to predict which ones are going to survive or if any of them do, and some new players come in.
Rest in peace, Napster.
Yeah, right. I'm waiting for my pets.com order as we speak. All right. So our next article is kind of like a man bites dog article. You know, it's kind of going the other way around. An existing incumbent bank, albeit not a huge one, has sold its their innovation department to fintech. So Umpqua Bank has sold its Pivotus division, their innovation subsidiary, based in Silicon Valley, to a fintech called Kony, K-O-N-Y. They didn't reveal how much they paid for it. It's a private transaction. But it's, you know, it's a little bit confusing. They mentioned that this is kind of like a human digital strategy is the way they put it. So they have you work chatting with somebody to help you with a loan or whatever it is, but you get to have your own banker. So you have a dedicated person that chats with you. Mm-hmm. So it's not a chatbot or anything. You actually get to a human, but you're chatting with them.
Okay.
So this is Umpqua's kind of a way of saying that they value the human interaction. They don't think a machine is good enough, but they want to interact with the way people interact with each other already, with texting and other ways. So they have some...
That's very in line with Umpqua's traditional stance, right? You know, they're a regional community bank. They're super focused on kind of a personal touch. They have really expanded their footprint with a focus on where will the people be? And they do some interesting things. Like they work very hard to make their branches not feel like a traditional bank branch. So they have coffee.
I've never been to an Umpqua branch.
Yeah, there's one not too far from where we're recording right now. They have coffee and tea and cookies. While they do have kind of a counter that your tellers sit behind, there are always there's always at least one staff person who's out and about. And the other thing, this is something that I actually think is really cool, aside from the fact that Umpqua is like so many consonants all smushed together, which I really like in a word, but they have dedicated public meeting space. So they have conference rooms that are available for free for anyone in the community. All you have to do is reserve it. And all of their branches operate that way, which I think is actually really cool. So it doesn't surprise me that they were really trying to find kind of this marriage of digital and human. And maybe it makes sense for them just to spin the technology piece off and either license it back or double down on
the they're still going to partner with Kony to provide those services. And like you said, they really want to focus on the human interaction, and that's part of how this initiative came about. Their product, Engage, was kind of their effort to scale this chatting ability and mix it with the human interaction. And so they have some software to so they can scale it up a little bit easier.
So what is Kony 2020 buying here?
Well, it looks like from the article that they're buying the entire subsidiary, the Silicon Valley-based group.
So the entire innovation group and likely its intellectual product.
Right.
Well, I have to say, as somebody who is not overall a huge fan of chatbots or even online chatting with actual humans, because you have to end up describing your problem over and over and over again.
It's also very slow, I find.
And I don't necessarily mind that because I can kind of do something else at the same time in a way that is less annoying than, say, being on hold on the phone. Mm-hmm. But the idea... I mean, this is an imperfect analogy, but if any of you have used like a shopping service like Trunk Club, where you have an assigned stylist who theoretically gets to know your preferences and what you like and what you don't like over time, that's kind of what Umpqua was going for here. I think that has a place in the market, right? You have a virtual person who assists you, who knows you. That's very cool. Nice.
Yeah, well, one thing they mentioned, it's kind of funny, is they said Umpqua was curious about whether people would feel comfortable sharing their financial information in a text kind of a chat environment.
Oh, they are. Absolutely. Yeah.
And yeah, that's right. The answer was an overwhelming yes.
Yeah.
So it became more and more useful because people were willing to open up and share. Maybe because they thought there was a human, a banker, an Umpqua dedicated person on the other side.
Yeah. Well, whenever you have a human on the other end, you actually have the chance to make a relationship.
Their first product, I guess the pilot name was called BFF, Best Financial Friend.
Aww, I love that.
That's adorable. Good for you,
Umpqua. Which is, based on what you told us about Umpqua, sounds about in line with their culture.
Yeah.
Is Umpqua headquartered in the Northwest?
It is.
Seattle?
Portland? I actually think it might be Portland or a suburb of. But their CEO, who's name escapes me, and he may not even be the current CEO, has written a number of books about kind of customer service and the place that banks can play in healthy communities. So, you know, Umpqua is very different from many of your more traditional and well-known banks in America. And that's not a bad thing.
All right, now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the interesting story behind it. Let's get started with some payments.
Sure. So my final bite is, this is kind of a callback to my earlier segment about IBM. My final bite, my number is $32 billion. Big money, big number.
Big money.
That is the number of the volume of payments that Zelle processed last quarter, which is a lot of money in and of itself, but it's also interesting because this compares to the $36 billion that PayPal did, and Zelle has been around for only
It's not that good a number.
I think it's...
is it a good number?
They've only been around for like 2 years. So
Zelle?
I think Zelle, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
but it's all the major banks together, right?
Yeah. Zelle is basically a product that was conceived by a consortium of banks through a company called Early Warning Systems. So you have your Chase,
BMA, there's a company City. That called themselves Early Warning Systems?
It actually began as a consortium through which the bank could share risk information about fraud or things like that. And now they got into sort of the product space. So they created Zelle a couple of years ago, which launched, I think, in Q4 of 17 or so, or maybe like Q2 of 17. But yeah, through the Zelle rails, which are now in all of your phones, if you bank with a major bank or most credit unions nowadays, they processed, again, $32 billion, which is, you know, it's a huge volume given how recent the company was created, or the product, rather.
So was around created. A year.
Around a year and a half or so, yeah.
I actually think that this number could really soar because even for, say, app-averse populations, Zelle is pretty much automatically integrated with your online banking
already. You don't even know that you're using it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, pretty much. So the first time I used it, a friend of mine sent me a request, and I was like, Zelle, what the hell is this? Because I refused to entertain all these silent E's that have no business there. But anyway, it's really, really easy to use. So if you're, say, you know, 50 plus and you don't already have a PayPal account and you're never going to get a Venmo account, you know, transferring money through Zelle might be very, very easy.
The one knock against Zelle, though, is that it doesn't have the same user interface or experience as you would get in like a Venmo or a PayPal. So, for example, I've heard complaints about people who maybe transfer money to somebody else and maybe they get the phone number wrong by one digit, and you really cannot get that back. And there's also no photo like you get in Venmo, so you can actually know who you're paying
the money to. But Venmo had those exact same growing pains not that long ago either.
Right.
So I think that that's pretty overcomable if Zelle decides that it's a problem worth overcoming. And in case you're wondering, Zelle, it is.
It is a big problem, yes.
Maybe absolutely. IBM can come in and fix this for them.
Yeah, I know that. So I actually did some research on Zelle. This could stay off. So I actually did some research on Zelle a few weeks ago, and they have the lowest rating in the app stores of any P2P service by far. I think it's like 1.7 stars versus 4 plus for like Venmo and PayPal and stuff. So pretty crappy experience.
But I've actually never used the app. I've just done it like logged into my online banking
and
then just transferred from there. that's where I actually think their play is. It's integrated already with your own bank account.
Yeah, and how much of that $32 billion is like within your own accounts or it's between banks?
It's between banking institutions, people.
Right.
You'd send it to another person. Oh, you would not use it to transfer, say, from your savings.
So they're not counting. No, I mean, are they, you know, counting those accounts?
This is purely
part of their number.
P2P payments.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're sure they're not fudging make their number look bigger?
Well, I'm almost certain.
It is the world of banking.
Steve is guaranteeing that that's not a fudged number.
Let's not put that on Steve. Yeah. Sarbanes-Oxley wouldn't require him to certify that result. Neither will we.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. I'm off the hook.
I'm still not impressed, though. I don't know. I think it's all the large
banks. For a
year
and a half, that's pretty good.
Yeah. But it's also all the largest banks. And
plus a lot of the regional banks also are coming on board, and they're actually onboarding more banks on an ongoing basis.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, they don't have the UI. If some of the other fintechs are integrating payments into what they do, and that's what people are getting comfortable
with. Don't forget
with.
The old people, John.
Yeah.
Old people have needs, too.
Old people...
and money. And they got to give it to their millennial children.
Old people, I think they use... I don't know if they're as hip with all the latest apps and everything, but... You know, they're large technology consumers as well.
Not a Venmo.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But they definitely use online banking.
All right. If you are if you want to counter Monica, please email me.
Yeah.
So I can have
and
some.
And we don't want your anecdata.
Anecdotes. Yeah.
Anecdata.
There was one guy who I got a text from over 40.
There was this one. God.
Yeah,
he might have been Canadian.
Right,
he was a friend of my cousin.
Yeah,
you're right. So yeah, let's see. All right, my final bite is $10 million.
What a puny number.
Puny number. Well, if you don't want it. Yeah.
I mean, it's no... what's the... It's no Powerball.
It's no Powerball.
Mega
billion dollars.
Yeah. Can do a few startups with that. So this is the amount that a startup called, and you're going to have to help me with this here. It's more like a math term than a name, but it's lowercase d, uppercase y, lowercase d, uppercase x.
I'm just shaking my head
Didix.
Here.
Didix. We're going to call it Didix.
Dynex, 9x.
Well, they're doing something kind of interesting, though, with that money, or they will with that money. They're going to do something called... anti-ether or dark ether.
Oh, God.
Wow. Okay.
No, I love that
Say
word.
Say more
I love
words,
that.
Please. Say more words.
No. This is what some people are calling it. But what they're working on is making it so you can borrow money from other people on the Ethereum platform. And what this means is that you can invest and short crypto assets. So I think it's one of those, again, one of those many thousands of tools that you're going to need to enable blockchains to do what's done on to replicate what's being done right now in the real world, and this is a key one: being able to invest on margin, short securities, being able to hedge your portfolio. These are all things that institutions and major investors are looking to do. Along with other things like research and custodial services that other exchanges are working on. So a really interesting concept. And what some people are calling this negative token that you would buy in order to short the Ethereum, it's called Expo, actually. You would buy an Expo in order to short Ethereum.
Dark Ether is better.
Yeah. So instead of shorting the token, you could call it anti-ether or dark ether, right? Like antimatter, dark matter kind of thing. So you buy this to short. And this is just one step. Their plans are to enable derivatives and other more complex financial securities on cryptocurrencies, none of which you can do now. For the most part, you can only go long on and just hold the cryptocurrencies.
You mean HODL?
Yes, pretty much. Hold on to death or life, apparently. So for now, you can use Expo, this shorted Ethereum for free. And they're looking at, in the future, a way to charge a transaction fee on this trade.
Should we expect to see more of these dark fill-in-the-blank currencies pop up?
Well, yeah, no, this is an effort across the crypto world, and especially with the exchanges that want to make it more friendly for large investors by providing them these tools that they're used to doing on large exchanges or between hedge funds doing derivatives. It's just so problematic right now.
Has anyone asked Elon Musk what he thinks of this?
What's his deal on crypto?
Oh, he's very against short sellers.
Yeah. Oh, he's against short sellers?
Oh, yes. Don't you know that that's Tesla's biggest problem? I don't know if you know that, John, but short sellers.
And Tesla short sellers, yeah.
Pedophile dive masters, I think, are Tesla's biggest problems.
That was weird. I don't know where did he get that info from?
I think it's the Ambien.
Yeah. So our official position is Elon Musk needs more sleep, natural sleep, and a co-CEO
and a board.
Somebody. Or someone like a Gwynne Shotwell, like he has for SpaceX to run things.
I'll start with just a functioning board that can check the power of the CEO.
Yeah.
How about that?
You know, another thing that makes this interesting and kind of like makes me think it's more probable that these guys could succeed is that they're getting investment from... the Andreessen Horowitz crypto-focused investment fund. It's called A16Z Crypto. That's their crypto-only investment fund.
Is it the one led by Kathy something or other?
Mm-hmm. Catherine Han?
Yes.
Catherine Han,
that's
yeah.
right. Formerly regulator, now on the other side. And Polychain Capital is also funding them. And these two have funded them for their first round where they got $2 million. And now they're coming back for more. So they like what they see. And they've mentioned how capable their coding and technical expertise is. So it's really a vote of confidence for that. Polychain Capital is a hedge fund that focuses on cryptocurrency-related investments.
Well, certainly, I think... you need to have hedging and short selling options in a grown up crypto world. So it's good.
Yeah. One thing that well, in theory will address, and it does in the stock and bond markets, is that it creates a little bit more stability because you don't have to rush in and out all the time. You can kind of do virtual or synthetic holdings, futures, that kind of thing, rather than dumping having only one way to express your position. Mm-hmm. So they're going to grow the team over at DYDX. And if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, they're looking for engineering, design, and operations. Actually, all of these companies, DYDX is hiring in San Francisco, Umpqua's innovation team is in Silicon Valley, and Tron is co-headquartered in Beijing and San Francisco. So if you're an engineer here, you're probably not listening to this and you're probably busy working.
or interviewing, yeah.
And if you're in marketing, go help DIDX get a new name.
My God, yes.
Yeah, it looks like a calculus kind of, I'm sure.
And I'm sure some calculus is involved.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of it is involved. So, Monica, what's your final bite?
Yeah, so my final bite comes out of a New York Times article that came out this week. And it's a nice, interesting article about quantum computing, which is widely considered to be the next phase in the world.
I like the way it's
computing.
A nice article on crypto computing.
It's a very nice polite article. Yeah, it's not a mean article. It's not a bad article. It's a nice article.
It's a good boy article.
But the key takeaway here is that the world of quantum computing is quite small. So the labor pool in this world is estimated to be less than 1,000 experts. So there is probably less than, you know, 4 digits worth of people in the whole world doing the leading research in the field.
Maybe there's more, but they're more modest and they don't want to call themselves experts.
Yeah, maybe they're even afraid to call themselves anything more than nice. And for those of you who are wondering, what is quantum computing? And I have to say that I've read a couple of articles on it, and I was too. I would like to quote just a little bit out of this New York Times article, because I think they do a nice job of summing it up. So traditional computers, the transistors inside them store bits of information, and each bit, as you probably already know, is either a one or a zero. And this is what kind of tells the computer what to do. But when some types of matter get extremely small or extremely cold, they behave differently. And that difference allows a quantum bit, or a qubit, to store a combination of one and zero. So not just the one or a zero, a combo. And two qubits can hold four values at once. See how it's getting exponential already? As the number of qubits grow, a quantum computer becomes exponentially more powerful. So the scientists who build these, and they right now are typically kind of PhDs who basically build these quantum computers by hand. So
I think also in China mostly, right?
I'm not necessarily sure about that. But they are fairly small scale at this stage, which is kind of a good thing, because if quantum computing, when quantum computing scales up, it is likely to be able to break all of the kinds of password authentication and security protocols that
256-bit SHA security
for sure
for blockchains.
And yeah, so all of that is potentially at risk once quantum computing ramps up. So you know, it's something to keep an eye on, and the New York Times article does frame it in terms of that the U.S. Is actually currently considered the leader. It's a very small field, mm-hmm. but that is an advantage that are likely to squander with our current immigration.
I'm surprised that number really is that low. You know, I read about the efforts, like D-Wave is the first commercial provider, you know, that they've done with Google and NASA. You know, IBM has their quantum efforts, you know, and a few other companies, I'm sure Intel. It's less than 1,000 that are experts. So master and a lot of...
I think it's because you're really moving into the world of physics rather than computer engineering. And it's certainly chip makers have been playing in the world of many domains for a long time. But because the transistor system is so either or and quantum computing isn't, I think it really makes it a different world.
So will this essentially break Moore's law? Like, I know we're kind of coming to the end of that. Will this?
Well, Moore's law is a semiconductor rule.
But
so if this is a qubit thing and quantum, then it doesn't apply, because it's the number of transistors per unit.
It basically becomes
I can't double. Say that quantum computing would break Moore's law. Moore's law has already been coming up against the laws of physics for some time now.
The physical limits. Yeah.
Right. So when, you know, chip builders have already been working at the scale of, you know, beyond microns. So I think that's where Moore's law has actually been facing the bigger challenge. It's just kind of...
It's already well below what the prediction is now, right?
I don't think
it's keeping up with what the law would predict anymore.
Correct.
But
correct.
They add more cores and they add more... graphic processors to help out.
Yeah, I mean, you can still make a bigger chip, right?
Yeah. Basically, quantum computers would get rid of Moore's law completely, and maybe blockchain security as well. It's the one thing that that we know, you know, where it might be possible with that kind of power in the future.
Yeah. So this will be something that we'll try and keep an eye on. There's it's certainly far outside of my expertise, but interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, and the New York Times is great for explaining these complex issues. I've learned about immunotherapy on there. I've learned about gravity waves on there. They've explained and space missions.
They really know their way with fake news, don't they?
Yeah, right. Yeah, they have very good graphics with their.
Yeah, they do have some really news. They have some really cool graphics.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions, comments, or would like us to cover any particular topic, please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. Please hit subscribe to keep up with our latest episodes. And thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.
Bye for now.